From 89.7 WUWM, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a former refugee from war-torn Bosnia recalls her harrowing escape and her journey to the United States.
Then the many ways World War I represented the beginning of modern warfare.
Submarines, tanks, gas, flamethrowers, machine guns, and of course planes too. And so there was this novelty to all of it, and there was kind of a improvisational aspect to it as well, as troops were kind of getting used to these new forms of warfare.
We'll learn about the effort to transform the iconic old soldiers' home into housing for at-risk and homeless veterans.
This is what this building was originally designed for. It was designed for housing for our neediest of veterans after the Civil War and continuing on into the 20th century up until the late 1980s when it was shut down.
And how to create a safe work environment when part of your job is to pretend to have sex on stage. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. The world is facing its worst refugee crisis in recorded history. Millions of people have been displaced by conflicts in Syria, South Sudan, and other countries.
While European nations have been grappling with the influx of people, the U.S. has placed a ban on immigration from many of the countries affected by these conflicts. But the situation that many Syrians face today is not too dissimilar from another crisis we dealt with just two decades ago.
The Bosnian War started in 1992. By the end of it, just 3 years later, more than 100,000 people were dead. Most of them were Bosniaks, victims of a genocide that targeted the Muslim ethnic group.
Zijada Boganovic was a young Bosniak child living near Sarajevo at the beginning of the war. She later came to live in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin as a refugee, where she met Lake Effect producer Joy Powers. They met at Zijada's home in Chicago, where Zijada explained what she remembers from her childhood in Bosnia.
As a little kid, I didn't know why we were leaving. I just remember something was wrong, and we left. We moved to Germany. My mom, my sister, and I actually left alone without my dad. And I remember like coming to this small town. What I know is that what happened in Bosnia is not even just Bosnia, but Serbia and Croatia. Mainly in Bosnia, struggled the most is that the religious differences was what brought this to be a very dirty war and a very sad war. I mean, majority of Bosnians had to leave because of the danger of the war, right?
So when the war started, about how old would you have been?
So the war, I remember, actually as a little girl, we were outside. My mom was hanging up the clothes on those, what do you call them, where you...
Oh, a clothesline?
Yes. She was hanging clothes up, and I remember those fast military planes. I remember one flying over us, and I was just thinking, that was really loud. I know things got kind of scary, like early 92, and we left in August of 92. So I was 4.5, my sister Jenny was 2. And we got very lucky because we were able to get out. If anyone waited, later on during that time, it was very hard to leave. Many people were stuck. If not, they wanted to stay because that's their country, that's their home, they wanted to fight. But my mom and my dad chose to leave for the safety of us, the girls.
You said that you, your mom, and your sister all fled first. Why did your dad stay longer?
I think a lot of the men had to stay to support, right, the Bosnian military. I don't know 100% to why. I know he had to for some reason. Never really asked. It just, people don't really like to talk about the past, especially the ones that are older and know exactly what happened. It's something that's not very talked about, unfortunately.
Now, do you remember fleeing to Germany? Do you remember that trip at all?
I do. It's really weird because thinking about it, even now, I can just close my eyes and remember parts of it. But being so young, sometimes I wonder, how am I remembering this kind of stuff? Is it because of how dramatic it might have been, or is it just my brain wanted me to remember? But I know there's few memories that I have. For example, my parents actually built a house. We finished it. We were just about to move in. Right before we were moving in, we were deciding, my parents were deciding to leave, and things were getting really bad. So where our house was, it was in a smaller village outside of the town, more secluded. And I remember being at our cousin's weekend house, she used to call it, and just watching out the window, just seeing black smoke. And where our house is, there's a giant field of grass. I mean, it's so beautiful. And then you have the mountains that you can see from the balcony, for example. And I remember our mom having to figure out how to get to the road, which was past the field and some trees. And she said that we ran through those fields not knowing if you're going to get shot from the soldiers that are behind you up in the mountains. So that was a challenge because you didn't know where the soldiers were. You couldn't see them. You know, they took advantage of the trees and the forest, and you just run and you hope that you don't get hit by a freaking bullet. And I do remember we were in this car that picked us up. This guy, the driver, thought that my mom was a friend of his. Apparently she looked like someone he knew who was Serbian. And he kept talking to her, just having this conversation. I remember my sister and I, we were in the back seat on the bottom, under the seats, just trying to be protected, just in case someone started shooting at the car. And I remember them talking, but she told me fully the story that he was assuming he knew her, and she never said she wasn't that person. He got us back into town where we were living in an apartment. So that was weird. That was probably scary for her, not knowing, like, what if he finds out? What's he going to do? You know, you just don't know. But I remember the bus ride out of Bosnia to Germany. So we ended up getting on a bus to leave. And I remember one part of this drive, I was looking out the window. And while I looked out the window, there's half a person in a ditch and half a person on the side of the road. Same person, just two pieces. I'll never forget that. And I asked my mom about it, and she just didn't know what to say. Like, how am I supposed to know that? How is she supposed to explain that? And then everything after that was kind of blurry. I remember we finally got to some European town. I don't remember where. It might have been Austria. And we were just sitting outside. And then finally we got to Germany.
How long were you in Germany?
Let's see. From 92 until 99. What is that, 7 years?
So you were in Germany a while.
Technically, my childhood, I grew up in Germany. And then my teenage years, I grew up here in the U.S. So Germany was very open to bringing in refugees, especially Bosnian refugees, and they opened their doors, which was amazing because there were so many of us who were trying to leave and protect ourselves and survive. But around, I think like 98 is when Germany was ready to send the refugees back home because things got better. And they took us in to help us out, but then, like, now you're okay, right? Now your countries are back to somewhat stable, and please go home. So we had the choice to either go home or come to the U.S. And my mom couldn't resist coming here. She's like, it's America, right? It's the land of the dreams, and how can you not take that opportunity? Because why would you go back home when your home's destroyed? There's nothing there. People are poor. You're like, it's still sad over there. Like, it's getting better, but there's so much poverty there still.
When you look back at your time in Germany, as someone who was a refugee, how do you process that time?
Honestly, I think about this all the time, and my sister and I talk about it too, and even my friend Isla. It feels like it's a different world. When I look back, I'm like, is that my childhood? I think about it, like, am I dreaming? Was that just a dream? It doesn't feel like it's my life because I've had my 4 years in Bosnia and then my few years in Germany and then here. I feel like my life was just, like, taken apart in different pieces. And the past is just someone's story, someone's movie, and I'm just looking back at it and thinking, oh, yeah, it doesn't feel real.
Now, what was it like when you came to the U.S.?
Scary, only because I watched so many American movies and saw tornadoes all the time. I always say this, man, I remember the sky was pink the first like few days when we got here. And I was like, you guys, there's going to be a tornado. And my cousins, Lana and Dado, like, no, 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 this is Lake Geneva. It's going to be fine. But I remember the drive home from the airport, just like the highway was so big. There's so much space. And because even in Germany, you had a lot of forest around you, a lot of mountains, right? Valleys. And one thing that I always found weird to me was that the blocks, the resident blocks, were squared, right? I never saw that before. So like riding my bike one day, I fell because I didn't know how to turn a corner from one side to the other. And I don't know, it was just, it was a different feeling coming here. It didn't feel real. And I imagine America to be so different from what it actually is.
You already had family in Lake Geneva, but did you feel like people treated you differently because you're nodding your head, yes?
Most definitely. I mean, Lake Geneva, as some of you might know, is a very small, I would say conservative town. And I don't think kids knew when I came to school, right, sixth grade, I don't think kids knew what a refugee was, what war meant, what anything like that really meant. All they knew was clothes and hanging out with friends, and I did not feel like I was accepted. I found that to be very challenging all throughout middle school and high school too. It was just, you're different, right? One of my history classes, I think it was in high school, there's like 2 pages, maybe 3, about the Bosnian War. That's all, right? And kids still don't understand who you are and why you're different.
Zijada Beganović is a Bosnian refugee who emigrated to Wisconsin nearly 20 years ago. For more about her story, head to WUWM.com.
Sarajevo was a flashpoint for war a century ago as well. That was where the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria triggered the First World War. Coming up after a break, we'll learn about the United States' involvement in the so-called Great War. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. This past April marked the 100th anniversary of the official entry of the United States into the First World War. The U.S. had already been fighting wars along the Mexico border and earlier in Cuba, but it took World War I to turn the United States into the global military power it has become.
One of the key figures in doing that was General John Blackjack Pershing. He was the supreme commander of U.S. forces in Europe at the time, and to this day is the only general to receive 6 stars rather than 5.
A new book, My Fellow Soldiers, looks at the legacy of Pershing and other famous and not so famous Americans who helped win the Great War. Author Andrew Carroll was on a book tour in Milwaukee last spring, and he joined us by phone first from his office in Washington, D.C.
I really think the story tells itself, and that's what drew me into it, because like many people, I wasn't really that fascinated in World War One. I run this project to preserve American letters, and we go from the Revolution all the way through up to Iraq and Afghanistan. So we cover letters from World War One, but they never kind of pulled me in the way that other conflicts had, especially World War Two. But once I learned more about Pershing in particular and his backstory, where he's seen as kind of this statuesque figure. I mean, you just look at the picture on the cover, and
he's stunningly handsome.
Yeah, and he looks like a man of steel. Like,
yep.
He looks really tough. But behind the scenes, I didn't know this story during the war, but before America got involved, this is in 1915. So he was in Texas at the time. He found out that his family, who was living at the Presidio, his wife and his 3 daughters. All died in one night in a house fire, and only his little boy, Warren, was pulled out alive. And he wrote these incredible letters to his friends and to other relatives about his grief and the loss, and it suddenly, when I came across these, like, really humanized him, and it made me want to learn more about who this individual was, who I think, I didn't know this at the time, a lot of people don't know, is the highest-ranking general in American history. He's the only general who, in his lifetime, was essentially given a 6th star for his service. And so, he eclipses all these other generals that have kind of, I think, overshadowed him, like, Patton and MacArthur and Eisenhower. So that in itself made me want to learn more about him.
And of course, as I learned, you know, his personal story, I learned more about the war and how he led it and how he was really brought in when America was not a major power. And so he really kind of had to build this army that went off to help the Allies win victory. And so that's why the book is very much not just about him, but about these other Americans, whether they're ambulance drivers or nurses or soldiers. And I really even follow the first Americans who volunteered even before America got involved. And this is back in 1914, 1915. So you have these young pilots and these young men who joined the French Foreign Legion and these women who were driving ambulances in actually pretty dangerous areas. And their story just became so compelling to me, and I wanted to tell it through their own words. So, you know, it's a nonfiction book, and I would like to think it reads kind of like a novel. But everything is true. Everything that's said is, you know, from actual sources, from journals, from letters and diaries. And it really, I think, gave me a much better sense of the sacrifices that these men and women made. The thing that also really struck me is that they were fighting a war in principle. America was not attacked. There was no like Pearl Harbor-like moment that encouraged these men and women to sign up. They just truly felt that Germany was in the wrong and that someone needed to stop them. And so it made it, I think, them much more noble in my own eyes than I'd really, I think, given them credit for beforehand.
You touch on something that was really kind of important to put it in context. Not only were we not in the war, most of us didn't want to go into the war. Pershing and people who were saying we need to do this were really in the minority. Public sentiment was against you.
No, absolutely. And also there was the political factor that the largest immigrant groups in America were the German Americans and the Irish Americans. So the German Americans certainly didn't want to go off and fight against their cousins or their siblings even, or, you know, even possibly their parents back in the fatherland. And the Irish were more than happy to see the British caught up in a major world war and wanted nothing to do with it. So right there, you have the two largest immigrant groups in America who really want nothing to do with this. And so kind of gradually, things started to change. You had the sinking of the Lusitania, where all these Americans died when the Germans torpedoed the ship. And then the key factor was what's called the Zimmermann Telegram. And it was a telegram, and it was a real document sent by Germany to Mexico saying, look, if you side with us and start, you know, trouble in the southern border, we'll try and have you recapture the lands that you lost in the Mexican-American War, like, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, and so forth. And so I think, you know, today people might think, well, we're not really at risk of being invaded by Mexico. But this is back when we actually had already been at war with Mexico. So this was conceived as a real threat. And Wilson was particularly infuriated. There's all this subterfuge behind the Zimmermann telegram itself, where the Germans actually went to the American embassy to send the telegram to Mexico. Now, obviously, it was coded. We couldn't read it, and they assured us that it was nothing, you know, major. But the Brits were actually intercepting our cables, and they didn't tell us this. So they came across it and had to figure out their own little plot to tell America how they discovered it without saying, we're kind of spying on you in the process. So talk about the whole behind the scenes that's going on with all this. And again, to me, it almost reads like a spy novel. And there's also this incredible love story with Pershing and a woman he fell in love with after his wife died and so forth. So there were all these components that just made it such a human story, and it's not about these massive numbers of casualties that we always read about, or, you know, just the trench warfare, which of course I talk about, but it's really the human element, and to draw people into these characters and to these situations that are just inherently dramatic.
One of the things that I think you also seem to touch on quite well in the book, although you're not talking about it explicitly, I don't think, is how so much changed because of the First World War. The way we think about diplomatic relations, certainly our army changed, and the way we thought about our military changed. And then there was all the art and the literature and the music that changed. And all of those things were kind of underneath what was going on.
Oh, absolutely. It was so revolutionary. I mean, here for the first time, you had, you know, in major use, submarines, tanks, gas, flamethrowers, machine guns, which really changed everything, and of course planes too. And so there was this novelty to all of it, and there was kind of a improvisational aspect to it as well, as troops were kind of getting used to these new forms of warfare. And so that in itself was fundamental, and it was something I really wanted to convey, especially with the pilots. I was really fascinated by these early combat aviators and what it was like, because these were very dangerous vehicles. I mean, they were up in the air. You know, the cockpits were open. They were freezing. They would have to, in the early days, change the machine guns by hand. So they'd have to stand up in the cockpit holding, you know, one hand on the throttle as they're taking out the drum and putting in the new machine bullets and so forth. And, it, you know, just all those little details made them come to life and I think really demonstrated just the sacrifices they were making and what they were going through.
Well, also, there was one part where you talked about, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting which pilot it was, talking about the beauty of going through the clouds.
Yeah, so a lot of these young pilots, the Americans, were from Harvard and from Yale. They were studying in France and Paris mostly. And so they loved the country, and they were just horrified when it came under attack. And so first they volunteered for the French Foreign Legion, and they legally couldn't join the French army because America was technically neutral. But when you join the Foreign Legion, you don't give your loyalty to France, you give it to the Legion. Now, this is a distinction the Germans thought was pretty ridiculous, but it's nevertheless how the Americans got around that at the time. And then after the Foreign Legion, when this new aviation corps was being started, they called it the Lafayette Escadrille, after Lafayette, who, of course, was the Frenchman who came to America during the Revolution to help us win that conflict. And so sort of in his honor, they named it the Lafayette Escadrille, and Escadrille was French for squadron. And just, you know, Victor in particular was this very artistic individual. And so he wrote back these really beautiful letters to his family about looking down, you know, thousands of feet up in the air, which was just, again, a totally novel experience for people. And just seeing the patchwork of the farmlands and the different colors and so forth, and how he loved kind of darting in between the clouds. And to think of how exhilarating that must have been back then for all of the discomforts they faced, again, like the freezing cold and everything that they were up against, it really gives you a sense of the rush of what they experienced and both their own sense of purpose, but also the dangers they faced.
Right, and a certain amount of infallibility which comes with youth.
Exactly. I mean, they really, in some ways, I mean, to some degree, they thought they were invincible, but they were also very aware of a kind of fatalism that, you know, if you were going to go, you were going to go. And there was really nothing you could do either way to stop it or to get through it. And Alan Seeger, who was mostly in the Foreign Legion, captured this, I think, the most powerfully in his poem, I Have a Rendezvous with Death. And I talk about Seeger's story and how it intersects with Chapman and so forth. And that, you know, I think what's overlooked is that the letters that these men and women were writing back at this time, as early as 1914 and 1915, were actually influencing the American public very subtly. But these letters were being shared. They were being published in newspapers. And I think it had some effect on the American psyche at that time.
Almost a, you know, a century-old version of social media, of somebody sending out a photo, and it in 1915 terms, it goes viral.
Absolutely. And people were writing one or two letters a day. I mean, it was very frequent. And so there was this sort of, I won't say barrage, but this constant messaging from the front lines. And they didn't really have to deal with censorship until the Americans came over officially. So what they wrote was very powerful and at times very graphic.
The other thing that you managed to capture in the book is the sense of, it's almost a disconnect between where the war was being fought and how close it wasn't being fought. So there was all of this stuff happening very close by that was not the trenches, not literally being shelled, not coming under fire. And it's almost kind of the last of the gentlemen's wars, if that makes sense.
No, it's funny you say that, because just going back to the pilots, I talked about it. In the early days, they actually didn't have weapons on the planes. They were used only for reconnaissance. So they would fly over, see where the enemy was based, and fly back and say, okay, they're over that hill or they're 2 miles away or wherever. And so when the pilots passed each other, the enemy pilots, they would almost wave and, you know, kind of give a jaunty hello to one another. And then, of course, when they start bringing weapons, things changed. But there was a bit of that old-fashioned sense of warfare. But once the machine guns came out and the gas was used and the flamethrowers, everything changed. And there was a real kind of hostility and a sense that, in fact, with the German soldiers who used flamethrowers, if they were ever captured by the French or the Americans, they were often just executed on the spot.
So this is, of course, before Geneva Convention rules.
Oh, yeah. And there actually were rules of international warfare that outlawed things like gas and so forth. But the Germans and then the French and the Americans, in retaliation, it all went out the window.
We just passed, on April 6th, the 100th anniversary of America joining the First World War. 100 years later, what have we learned, and what can we learn from looking back at the First World War?
I think one of the greatest lessons that we should learn is how quickly events can spiral out of control. And this is not when America was involved, but when you look at the shooting of the Archduke, and I try and, you know, retell that scene very vividly, and then the repercussions it had. And what really struck me is that the Russians and the Germans, we kind of think of these in large geopolitical terms, but actually the Tsar and the Kaiser were first cousins. They had grown up together as little boys playing in their, you know, Queen Victoria's gardens in Buckingham Palace. And they were sending, in the early part before the war really exploded, these personal cables back and forth where they referred to each other as Nicky and Willie. And, you know, the Germans were more hell-bent on war than the Russians were, but you still see this kind of personal correspondence going on that makes it all, you know, not large and abstract, but very human. And that's one of the things I really want to convey, that, you know, nations are not these sort of grand entities that declare war, that it's individual human beings who do this, and that, like human beings, nations feel pride and humiliation, and they act rashly, or they act soberly, whatever the case may be. But to really put it in terms that I think we can all relate to, as opposed to, oh, we've got to read about, you know, the Russian government, the German government, and, you know, these millions of troops being amassed, it really does come down to the human element.
Pershing ended up dying as an old man, but happy, because he ended up finally marrying the woman that he fell in love with in France.
Yeah, and I include some of his love letters to show that side of him. And what's really amazing about the relationship, it was a young, she was Romanian in, by birth, but she lived in Paris, and that's where they met during the war, was that she was very understanding of Pershing's continual love for his first wife. And there's even a letter written on the 10th anniversary of the fire where Pershing writes to Micheline, his new fiance, about, you know, the loss of Frankie, that was the name of his first wife, and the three girls, and how old they would have been at this point, and just that, you know, he still had never really gotten over the grief. And then there's a really beautiful letter he wrote to Micheline that he gave to his then-grown son, Warren, to give to her once Pershing passed away. And so when he died in 1948, this letter was given to her, and I obtained the original copy. And it's one of the most beautiful love letters I've ever read. And again, it just shows a different side of someone who, you know, almost seems more machine-like than man. He was so tough and rigid and not very personal. And he wasn't loved the way other generals were, but he really was an extraordinary individual. And he had real feelings for his troops. And it's one of the reasons why he was so tough, is because he wanted them to return home alive. And he knew that that would be a better chance if they, you know, were very disciplined and hardworking and so forth. But, you know, again, my intention was to show the American troops, but also Pershing, in a new light, and why I think they really deserve to be remembered.
Andrew Carroll is the founding director of the Center for American War Letters at Chapman University. His recent book is called My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War. We first spoke with him in April.
We'll take another break now and then learn about the work that will soon transform the iconic Old Soldiers Home in Milwaukee into a modern facility to serve current veterans. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee's Old Soldiers Home was built in 1867 to serve veterans of the Civil War. Today, it's one of the three original soldiers' homes still standing around the country.
But the original building has been out of regular use for nearly three decades, and the years of neglect have taken their toll. There's peeling paint everywhere, mold damage, crumbling floors and ceilings. The facility was listed on the National Trust for Historic Preservation's 11 Most Endangered Sites list 6 years ago, and since then, efforts have been underway to preserve it.
And that's finally what is going to happen. A $40 million public-private partnership will see six buildings, including the iconic original Old Main Building, rehabilitated and developed as housing for more than 100 homeless or other at-risk veterans.
Work is scheduled to get underway early in the year, but I had a chance to step inside the 150-year-old building recently and talk with several of the people involved in the effort. Jonathan Beck is the development project manager for the Alexander Company, the developer that will conduct the restoration work.
This project is no small task. The building has been closed since 1989. It has fallen into disrepair, but not unlike, you know, many structures, you know, around our country, we are going to be doing an adaptive reuse.
Define for people who aren't familiar with it, what you mean by the term adaptive reuse.
Adaptive reuse means we are going to be, you know, bringing back the exterior and the main corridor, you know, historic features, and preserving those while adaptive really using the building and bringing it up to today's standards. So new mechanical, electrical, plumbing, new units, fixtures, and making it habitable again. It's not preserving, per se, you know, like a museum quality. It's an adaptive reuse of retrofitting the building while keeping all the prominent historic features that the Department of Interior wants to see in a National Historic Landmark building.
Right. I was going to ask how you decide what the features of the original. I mean, we're looking around us, and there are these pillars that are kind of crumbling, but
right.
Some of the work on them looks like, you know, something that you would never see in 2017.
Right. You know, on deciding what is kept and what goes, it's a real negotiation between our architects on this project. It's Elan Wilson and then the owner, Alexander Company, and the Housing Authority, working with the State Historic Preservation Office and the National Park Service to define really, you know, how do we best meet the Department of Interior standards when looking at each of these historic features. So, you know, the slate roof, that's staying. These columns are staying. In the interior corridor, the entryways and the grand arches, those are staying. There's 568 windows, all unique within themselves. Those are all staying. But again, you know, all new electrical systems, mechanical framing, that will all be new.
How much did you know about what you'd face for the renovation before you walked in this? I mean, this building had been off limits for a long time. How many question marks were there before you could get in and really figure out what it was going to take?
Well, I think that there's always question marks going into any, you know, historic building like this. But our company was founded in the early 80s, 1982. We've done over 150 adaptive reuses of historic structures all around the country. Each one is very different, but you know, we know how to go about tackling a project like this. We actually just started construction on another Milwaukee project called the Fortress Building, which is in the Brewers Hill neighborhood. It's about a $55 million redevelopment, similar size and scope of complexity, but a lot of the same challenges. But that's why the Department of Veterans Affairs, when they selected a development team, they wanted a group that had that expertise in tackling tough projects like this. So.
Explain where we are and what this space stands to be, or spaces like it stand to be.
Right. This right now we're right near the original entrance of the main building. It's the grand entrance. Unfortunately, it's not a handicapped accessible entrance, but it will remain an exit. But this would be right where we're standing. As you can tell, that we're in what's going to be a unit with 10-foot high ceilings, enormous windows, great light. This would be a one-bedroom unit. In the main building, we're going to have 80 units, 72 one-bedrooms, 8 two-bedroom units, and approximately 20,000 square feet of supportive service space for the veterans living here. In the remaining buildings, we will have 21 units. Some of those are family units, three bedrooms. Others are single-room occupancy units. But again, it'll be a collective of 101 units. Main building, 80 units. That's the first phase that we anticipate to start construction.
When you dig into one of these projects where you're taking a historic space like this and, as you describe it, you know, doing an adaptive reuse of it, and you stand in a place like this, is your mind full of what this is going to look like someday?
Oh, I mean, that's one of the most rewarding aspects of the job that I, and the career that I've developed over the past 20 years, is always the before and the after. So to have that vision of what this space looks like after we're done with the renovations, definitely.
What's the time frame?
We hope to start construction first quarter of next year. It'll be a 16-month construction time frame, and we hope to be placed in service with residents living here in late 2019.
I'm looking forward to standing in this same space in like 18 months.
Right, and you know, just like, so we're celebrating the 150th of the start of the construction, but it took 2 years in 1867 to develop the building, and it'll take us 2 years really to get this, the doors open again.
Jim Duff and his organization are also a key part of the equation. Duff is the director of the Milwaukee County Veterans Service Office and describes himself as a cheerleader on the project. He says it was important to be able to provide services to at-risk veterans and also important to be able to do that in these buildings.
Well, I think, first of all, this is what this building was originally designed for. It was designed for housing for our neediest of veterans after the Civil War and continuing on into the 20th century up until the late 1980s when it was shut down. We have a large population of very low-income veterans in our area, many of them in danger of homelessness on virtually every month. The 101 units that are going to be created here by Alexander Company are going to go a long way to providing stable, affordable housing for those veterans, and in some cases for small families. So it's a necessary and a needful project for this area.
The project involves stakeholders at several levels, from Milwaukee County to the Department of Veterans Affairs, from the Alexander Company to the National Trust for Historic Preservation. But the community at large is playing a role as well. While $36 million in funding is secured, an additional $4.25 million is the target for the Save the Soldiers Home campaign. H. Carl Miller, CEO of Miller Communications, is co-chair of the campaign. The recent trip to Old Main was his first time inside the building, and he explained why this effort spoke to him.
Well, you know, I'm from the Vietnam War era, and in addition to everything else, a couple of my best friends went into the Army, were drafted into the war, and one at least came out severely psychologically affected by it. Wound up becoming a homeless vet, finally rescued from the streets of New York, brought back home, never recovered, and committed suicide. So I think a lot about the young men that went to war, served their country, came back, and really couldn't find a place back here, never had a future. Bright, young, strong young men. And I think about the services that can be provided at a place like this where they feel not just welcome, this is a home for them, for all the reasons you've heard from other veterans. I think very important to serve that purpose, but doing it and preserving this legacy is pretty incredible. Yeah.
It is really amazing to be standing in this space and imagine what it was 150 years ago.
Exactly. And how the returning vets from the Civil War had nowhere to go, no hospitals, no homes, nothing, and how the women of Milwaukee decided to do something about it and built an incredible legacy that we almost lost. I mean, it was in real danger of just collapsing. So being able to accomplish all this in one program is pretty unique and pretty special for everybody.
Is there... I guess there's no really good way to put this. Does it sadden you in some way that we have to raise money in this way, that we as a country just haven't committed the resources to doing what needs to be done for veterans who are at the greatest risk?
Well, you could put it that way. I think it's an exciting opportunity for a relatively small amount of money to leverage all this investment. And I really believe we can and will do it. And then once we're done with this, people get excited. Okay, what comes next? What else can we do? So I think what we've received so far is a lot of enthusiastic support. And I don't think we need to go to the taxpayers every time we try to do something.
Carl Miller is CEO of Miller Communications and the co-chair of the Save the Soldiers Home campaign. We also heard from Jim Duff, the director of the Milwaukee County Veterans Service Office, and from Jonathan Beck, development project manager for the Alexander Company.
At WUWM.com, we have a slideshow of what the inside of Old Main looks like today, and we'll revisit the space as work gets underway.
We'll take one last break and then learn about the difficult but necessary work of choreographing intimacy on stage in a way that's both believable and safe. That's when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The mission of Tanya Sina's organization, Intimacy Directors International, is to create safe spaces for dangerous work. The dangerous work in question is intimacy on stage, which at first glance might not seem terribly dangerous, but if not handled correctly, intimate scenes between actors on stage can place one or both in awkward, uncomfortable, or even abusive situations, even when no malice was intended.
Sina is changing that dynamic one production at a time. Her organization works with theater companies worldwide to stage sexual or other intimate scenes so that the actors are protected and the audience gets a believable scene to watch. Sina is based in Oklahoma City, but she was working remotely with Renaissance Theater Works earlier this fall. She joined me on the phone then to explain how her organization began.
Since my background is in fight direction, I use a lot of exercises from those earlier formative years where I learned how to set up a fight, how to set up a duel, how to create tension. You know, you can't start a fight without tension. And I realized that most of those rules still applied to intimacy. And I actually, when I was trying to figure out what to call this, I called it intimacy very specifically because most of what I do is not sex. You know, that's a thing. That's one part. Intimacy is a huge umbrella. And under that, there's intimacy between parents and, you know, children. There's intimacy between siblings. There's lots of different kinds of intimacy. But for the most part, what I was finding was whenever there was a sex scene on stage and actors were asked to do things, the director would leave it to them to choreograph themselves. And it's nearly impossible as an actor to see from the outside what you look like, especially when it comes to intimacy. So my job became, and things started coming my way from other student-directed projects, which is where all the sex is in school. They came to me and asked me if I could choreograph all of their intimate scenes. And I started getting a lot of practice. It wasn't easy. I had to be desensitized. Because it was uncomfortable for people to talk about things.
I was going to ask about that. I think one of the difficulties is that as a society, we are both titillated and uncomfortable with sex at the same time. And
absolutely.
So, and watching people imitated on stage can be a profoundly uncomfortable experience for the audience, not to mention the actors.
Absolutely. I've seen shows get ruined by a really bad intimacy scene because the audience is uncomfortable or they laugh uncomfortably because it's inappropriate or the director was going for something that wasn't what the playwright was intending or the actors don't understand what they're doing or there was no coach on this, so it's under rehearsed, or they're improvising. And improv is a terrible thing, a terrible way to go about choreographing intimacy. If you just say, okay, now you just go ahead and kiss, there's a million different ways to kiss. So essentially the method is, you know, I give you a roadmap as a coach. I'm on the outside watching you because sex on stage is not real. It's just not real. People who are opposed to this will say, don't you want it to look real and authentic and not choreographed? And the answer is it isn't. It doesn't look choreographed when it's choreographed well, just like a fight.
Right.
You shouldn't see the choreography. You should see the intimacy between the actors. But you can't get to that level of comfort unless you rehearse it properly.
And that means trust. And that means trust between the two actors who are in an intimate moment, whatever that moment is, but especially a sexual one. And then trust between those two actors and the person coaching. I mean, you have to build that over time, I would think.
Yeah. Every production that I work on is completely different. And so, you know, when people ask, okay, what do you do in this situation? It's so dependent on the actor's needs and their own sort of experiences of what they've had on stage and where they're seeing the character that I need their input. So it's very difficult to not ask the actor's questions. They're involved in that process just as much as the director is. But as a choreographer, I'm there to make every little piece of it choreographed, every hand. I know where their hand placements are. I know the choreography, and then I give that to the stage manager. that way it doesn't change after I leave.
Now, in most theater productions, the two people who have been cast in the two roles don't have any say over who they're going to act opposite. And so how do you help build trust maybe where there isn't any, you know, I got cast in this role and this other person got cast in this role and I don't particularly like that person.
Yeah, it happens all the time.
I bet it does. And it's one thing in a, you know, in an office situation to say, well, you know, you're at work and you go to work and you put everything else aside, but your work is to be intimate.
Yes.
And so how do you work with that kind of a situation?
Well, I mean, that happens almost all the time where either they don't know each other or, you know, they have had experiences. If you're lucky enough to walk into a company who has been a company before and they have worked together for years, that's easier, but it doesn't make it easy. Even when the actors say, well, we've kissed before, so we know how to do this. That's usually them being brave. And I'm still going to choreograph you. I mean, as many times as you have kissed this person on stage, even if they're married in real life, I still need to choreograph your scene. It's going to be easier if you have physical boundaries that you don't have with each other than if you don't. You know, some people have boundaries with their body where they say, I don't like to be touched in certain places, or I can't be touched here because I just don't like it. I can choreograph around that. Whereas if there's no communication of that, and something happens accidentally, somebody might be triggered from their past or somebody might have some kind of trauma on stage and it could be actually permanently damaging mentally to them. So the question, I'm sorry, going back to your question, which was, what do you do? Part of the method is I've designed exercises that are specifically built to help two strangers find chemistry first before we choreograph anything. And they can be two strangers, they can be two friends that actually know each other. You know, sometimes they're actors that already know each other, but they've never done a love scene before. But they have to find that kind of chemistry that maybe they don't have in real life. And so my job of being the outside eye, and I'm controlling it from the outside eye, it helps the actors feel like it's not them controlling it. Because as soon as the actors feel like one of them has to be in charge, the other one is following. So they're going, okay, so he's leading me and he's kissing me like this and his hand is going there. What does that mean? I didn't tell him to put his hand there. Does that mean that he likes me? Or is that his character doing that? And our brains get mixed up because it's a sexual response. That's a real thing. Your body will respond to being touched, even though it's fake. Mm-hmm. So the difference between fights and intimacy is actually really huge. The longer you do a sword fight with somebody, you don't hate them more. But the longer you do an intimacy scene with somebody, you do become more intimate with them, generally. So that's a big difference, and that's where a lot of showmances can happen. That's where a lot of inappropriate sexual harassment can happen, or even abuse, which, as we've seen in Chicago, we've had a lot of situations that are now coming up in the news where people are kind of putting their foot down and saying, we can't be abused anymore. We don't want to be abused anymore. Can we have a safe work environment, even though it's the arts? And that's the question that we're posing. We want to prevent sexual harassment before it happens. And we do that with communication and with proper protocol when we handle these scenes. Intimacy Directors International is our company. I have two other co-founders that we go around sort of internationally choreographing and teaching workshops in this to get the word out, because we want this to be a movement of a new way, a new protocol to approach these scenes, trying to go to training programs so that people learn this early and they don't get damaged before they leave the industry. Our whole method is based around the pillars of communication and the pillars of intimacy, which we need to have consent from the actors. You have to be able to consent to somebody touching you. We need to communicate that consent properly. We also need to choreograph it from the outside perspective, from a coach or the outside person that is not the actors. And then mostly from there, we hand it over to the stage manager who continues that process on, and that way it stays safe for everybody. And the playwright's wishes are part of that. I've seen directors that try to put their own vision onto sexual scenes just to shock an audience. And if you want to shock an audience, you can. But it's already shocking to see intimacy in person. So you don't have to do a whole lot.
I was going to say, most of us feel uncomfortable, like we're looking at something that we shouldn't be looking at.
Right. It feels private. You know, we love watching fights. Fights are like, ooh, look at this violence. Look at people shooting people and people cutting people's heads off. And, you know, that seems to be no problem for us. But the second we see two people kiss, suddenly something we recognize in ourselves is the part that makes us feel uncomfortable, is we identify with that. It's hard to identify with a murderer, but we can identify with sexual feelings. So that's why it's hard to handle for some people. And I think that the voice of change needed to come from females in the industry to say, this is what we've been experiencing. I don't know if you know, but almost every sex scene that I've been in as an actress has been improperly choreographed. And I've watched it happen to other people. I've been an enabler. I've just sat and watched while other people were sort of abused while having to be choreographed. And I've also been an aggressor myself. I've accidentally hurt somebody's feelings in the process. So it doesn't mean that everybody that hasn't been doing this properly before is a monster. It just means that you don't know the process. And that's what we're trying to put forth, is that there is a process now. And if you're above your head on a project, you can always find an intimacy director or a movement choreographer to help you.
I assume you're hoping that more theaters will engage you or one of your colleagues to make sure that going forward we have safety nets in place for actors?
Yeah. Well, what we're doing is we're actually really trying to expand very quickly, because three people can't cover the entire international, you know, scope of theater. So what we're doing is we're opening up, we have a candidate program for right now. They're all master teachers that just haven't learned this particular process. And we're going to be releasing them so that I have more teachers that can help teach this to other people. Essentially, I'm giving away my entire research, and I'm also writing a book so that people can use it. But for the most part, we're trying to expand. And even if you need just somebody who can be in the room with you, or if you just aren't sure, you can always email us or contact us. If it's a non-equity show, you probably don't have a contract, and that's different. If it is an equity show, they have deputies that handle these things, that handle certain processes after the fact, which is great. What we don't have yet is preventing any offenses from happening before they happen. And with the communication, usually you can. So it's becoming worldwide now that we're just tired of the abuse that's been in the performing arts for however long it's been there. And we just want a safer working environment, just like everybody else.
Tanya Sina is founder of Intimacy Directors International. We spoke with her earlier this fall. There is more information about her stage intimacy work at WUWM.com. That is all for the Tuesday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I am Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.